This is Salam Media from South Africa.
You are with myself, Inayat Wadi. This is the Alternative Voice. We are going to be focused on the Bilderberg Group. I'm sure many of you have heard of the Bilderberg Group. I came across a very interesting article on the Bilderberg, and I'm sure my guest, Tony Gosling, who is the editor of the website www.bilderberg.org, and he's done extensive work, extensive research into who this Bilderberg Group is all about. I think for many of us, at face value, it is about this group of elites that meet once a year in some secret location and obviously discussing various issues. But who are these people? What is the agenda? And that is what we aim to discuss tonight. And from the UK, we join on the line now by Tony Gosling. Tony, good evening to you, and welcome to Salam Media.
Hi, very much. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
Yes, Tony. In fact, you know, when I went onto the internet and I was reading up on the Bilderberg Group, and your name came up, and immediately I went into your website. And really, there is just so much that is written, and I'm sure the next hour or so won't even be enough. Won't even do justice to discussing this topic, because there's just so much to talk about. But I think just to start off with, your interests, and you know, I know you've got quite a biography, and I'm sure if I go through that, possibly you'll spend another 10 minutes or so. But just your interest in the subject of the Bilderberg Group, how did that come about?
Okay, yes, I was working for the BBC back in the 1990s, early 1990s, and it kind of frustrated me when in 1996 I was first told about Bilderberg to know nothing about it. I think the climate of the media has changed massively, really, since the mid-late 1980s. Certainly here in Britain. I mean, I can't speak for other parts of the world. But before that, we had a very healthy, I think, investigative documentary scene on the television. We had a similar sort of thing on the radio. And certainly the newspapers were spending a lot more time investigating things. And actually, if you go back to the 1950s, even when Bilderberg first started, you'll find there's actually quite a lot of press coverage of the meetings, not of the detail of what's going on in there, but the fact that all these powerful people were getting together. And I think the last Bilderberg conference, which was back in June this year, just a month or so ago, a bit more than a month ago, the coverage in the British press was virtually zero. So what we've seen is, even though that the time has rolled on, from the 1950s to now, what's that, about 60 years or so, you know, even coming up towards 70, of an understanding and analysis of this, the actual reporting of it by the mainstream press has actually, I think it's fair to say, gone down. Now, there's been a lot online, a lot of blogs and things like that, bits and pieces, but they're, when I first started looking into this in the mid-1990s, 96 actually it was, I was pretty horrified to see that there was so much anti-Semitic stuff from the far right saying that this is some kind of Jewish conspiracy, which was, it really was kind of toxifying any kind of coverage that there was the fact that if you search for Bilderberg, this is what you got, either nothing or that. And so I set, I suppose, off on a mission to try and do some proper journalism around who they are, what, you know, what their origins are, it are, what their power is, what their place in society is, and I suppose most importantly, why our mainstream press in the West has just totally failed to cover issues around the most powerful people in the Western world.
Now, just looking at the Bilderberg Group, and you know, obviously looking at the origins, were you able to establish as to the origins of the Bilderberg Group, and what was the agenda then, and has this agenda actually changed over a period of time?
Well, I mean, the agenda does change a bit. I mean, that's easy to deal with. I'll deal with that straight away, which is the banking fraternities. Okay, so if you look at the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds have been involved in this, and the Rockefellers began as an oil industry kind of conglomerate, and then moved into banking, because banking, you can just make money up, you know, at the press of a button. It's much easier than having to pump oil out of the ground, even if you've got a monopoly on the oil. So that was really through the 90s and the noughties when I was first looking into this. It seemed to be very much a banking fraternity. And, of course, Goldman Sachs were one of the big, probably the biggest feature, largest at Bilderberg. And what we've seen more recently over the last few years is migrating away from that banking interest running things and deciding things. And, of course, the bankers are really a kind of new feudal system. They're very much unregulated. There isn't any proper regulation of banking. They can do what they want. And when they're caught committing crimes, they get away with it too. I mean, as we've seen with HSBC in the US and the billions of dollars of fines for money laundering with the Mexican drug cartels, the LIBOR, the foreign exchange fraud, all this stuff, which has been signed off by senior executives at banks, has gone unpunished by, you know, by them. I mean, there's a few people like Tom Hayes who've been locked up for it, very minor figures who've been basically doing it as part of their job description, you know, and they've been jailed. So what we've seen it move towards is more of the Peter Thiels and Eric Schmidt's moving in to take over at the steering committee, because you get about 120 people at the Bilderberg conference, but there's a smaller steering committee of around about 20. And the tech financiers and Eric Schmidt from Google, these are the sorts of people now who seem to feature most heavily, or seem to be the most, it's really difficult to tell what exactly is going on. But if you look at the profiles of those that are steering things at the Bilderberg Steering Committee, that's it. It's tech, you know, some would even call beast tech. If you look that term up, you know, there's this whole kind of way that technology is moving in this completely unregulated manner, so that it's used as a method of mass surveillance of literally billions of people and collecting information on them, which of course then can be used against them and can be sold, etc. So it's completely deregulated. But I think the main reason why the people like Thiel and Schmidt figure so highly at Bilderberg is because this is the future of news. The future of the media is going to be, you know, is already through the internet. As soon as the newspapers started going web first, in other words, publishing on the online before they published in the newspapers, it was quite clear that's where the way that the news media is heading. And we've even just seen in the last week or so, the Press Association here in Britain, which is the, you know, semi kind of autonomous but really controlled by the industry, Press Association, which, you know, puts out the wire service, the main wire service for Britain, they've now got a big grant to do automatically generated, artificial intelligence generated news with artificial intelligence journalists. So they've got a big grant to do that. I think it's €500,000 or something. So we're seeing it moving in that direction, where we're getting news and information which is being put together by, not by human beings, you know. And you do wonder actually if most of our politicians are not human beings either, the way they react. So that's where Bilderberg is heading. What's their sort of wider agenda? What are they looking at in the wider sense? I think it's really, it's effectively a kind of secret government, because it's gone beyond lobbying. Now it's in charge. It's able to use its media, big media and big banking and top levels of politics members to put people in power. I mean, look at what's happened with Emmanuel Macron in France. I mean, he's a guy who a couple of years ago was a Mr. Nobody at Bilderberg. Suddenly all the backing of the media and the banks is behind him, and he's come from absolutely nowhere to take over France. So that's why I don't hesitate in calling Bilderberg a secret government rather than just a lobby. As a lobby, it's a lobby for the NATO war machine. It's a lobby in the NATO countries almost exclusively. I mean, they do have some people from China and on the periphery, but usually they're very pro-Western. I mean, from Russia, they have been in the past, right, from the Carnegie Endowment. But that's effectively what we're dealing with here. I think it's it's a government behind the scenes, a parallel government, a secret government. Our governments in Europe, particularly with the EU at the moment, are so weak. You know, look at Greece, for example. I mean, you know, pathetic. And Britain, in fact, as well, with Theresa May in charge, who's, you know, kind of from the authoritarian end of the Tory party. She's got no political authority at all. no real mandate. But so we've got very weak national governments. Bilderberg are the people that are calling the shots right now.
Yes, Tony, an interesting thing that I actually read up, and when you talk about the cloud of secrecy surrounding the Bilderberg group and being in charge, and one of the objectives of the Bilderberg group and the group's grand design is moving to a one world government, and talking about single global marketplaces, talking about a one world army, talking about a single global currency and the like. Just your thoughts on these objectives, and you know, are they working towards these objectives?
Well, I mean, people sort of, I think, fantasize a bit about Bilderberg being all-powerful. They're certainly not, but their objectives are, I think, around the use of war. I mean, this has been being done for centuries, by the way. You know, go back and have a look at Napoleon, for example, to reshape the world. I mean, this has happened in the First World War, the Second World War, with the Zionist Project, for example. And they're definitely looking to consolidate. One of the things that convinces me of that is looking at the links to Freemasonry from Bilderberg. I mean, one of the things that quite shocked me was that there was no real information online about Bill Clinton's being a Freemason. I can assure you he was. I've seen plenty of photographs of him in his Masonic regalia, and he's the sort of person that it was said there was actually an issue of Freemasonry Today all about Bill, you know, with all these pictures in, and yet this side of it doesn't seem to have been recognized. I mean, the Freemasonry was very much involved, for example, in Italy, in consolidating all these various little city-states and provinces into one country. This is what these people do. You know, that's one of the things that they're into. And if you're looking at, I mean, my evidence from Bilderberg was that, I mean, very few people see or look at this aspect of it, is Andrew Palmer, who was the organizer of the Bilderberg Conference at Turnberry in Scotland at the end of the 1990s, one of the last to happen, the second to last to happen here in Britain, was the PA to, personal assistant to the Duke of Kent, who's the Queen's cousin, and the Grand Master of United Grand Lodge, you know, which is supposed to be one of the top bodies in world Freemasonry. Well, it is. You know, it's one of the, well, Britain was where this stuff allegedly, anyway, in the 1700s first emerged as a proper, you know, organized fraternity. So that was interesting to see that someone so close to the Duke of Kent, you know, entrusted by the Duke of Kent, was an organizer for a Bilderberg conference. But then also, if you go back to when it first started in 1954, Joseph Rettinger as well was a Freemason too. He was working with MI6 during the war, very much implicated in the death of the Polish General Sikorsky in Gibraltar at the end of the war, which was very convenient since Churchill was selling Poland out to the Soviet Union. I mean, that wouldn't have gone down well with Sikorsky if he'd been alive. So those two characters, and Rettinger was very, very important in forming Bilderberg back in the first years around 1954. Incidentally, when I went to Germany a couple of years ago for the Dresden Conference back actually just last year, it was really interesting to chat to a guy called Klaus Kopf, and you'll see the interview up online if you want, Bilderberg Exposed in Dresden. He was able to talk to one of the very first ever participants in the 1954 conference, first Bilderberg conference, actually at the Bilderberg Hotel in Oosterbeek in Holland, and that's a whole other story. We'll get into that if you want later, why that was the original place they had the first conference. And he spoke to the secretary, a woman who's a secretary to him, to one of the first participants, because he died long ago, but she was still alive, and she said, oh yes, Bilderberg, I remember that. All the stuff to do with that was top secret, but I do remember that it was Archbishop Frings, who was the Archbishop of Cologne, that actually came and personally invited him to come to that Bilderberg conference, as well as I think it was Otto Jorn was the name of the guy who was the head of the Verfassungsschutz, which is the basic, a sort of equivalent of of MI5 in the very early days of the Federal Republic of Germany. So really top people had come to invite this guy who'd started, and he'd started the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung newspaper just after the war, and he was invited to the first conference. So they've always been interested, right from the word go, in the top newspaper people and top bankers coming along. And not everybody is impressed, as Will Hutton, when he came. He was the editor of the Observer back in the 1990s. When he went to the Bilderberg conference, he wasn't that impressed. He came out and he said, these people are the high priests of globalization. They set the agenda against which policies decided worldwide. You know, this is by bodies like the IMF, etc. So they're a really, really powerful bunch. Sitting in the middle of it all, like a spider, is Henry Kissinger. You know, he's based, of course, at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York, which is where all the big parties were thrown in the late 1930s before an early 40, you know, 1940, 41, before the Americans entered the war, you know, by the Nazis were thrown in Waldorf Astoria. And so Kissinger is a very key figure at Bilderberg. And I think everybody is, you know, the more you look at him, the more you can see that he never really went out of power. He just privatized his power after Nixon.
Yes. Now, Tony, just I'm listening to what you're saying, and just over and above the secrecy that is surrounding the Bilderberg Group, in terms of the public mind and programming the public mind, you know, I know you mentioned Freemasonry, but also, you know, I think this whole link with the Illuminati and the like as well. And we've seen so much being written in terms of programming the public mind and this web of control where, you know, these people wield enormous power, not only, you know, of governments, but also on other matters that impact on the population right across the world.
Well, yeah, you using the word Illuminati, I wouldn't do that. But, I mean, certainly the historical Illuminati is worth looking at and comparing to what we see. I mean, the evidence for the historical Illuminati is absolutely massive, overwhelming. And, I mean, I wouldn't call Bilderberg the Illuminati because I don't have any actual evidence for it. But they certainly look similar. I mean, interest in sort of overturning all aspects of human society to their own will. For example, looking at politics and political parties and manipulating that through the press and also through religion. If you think about it, politics and policy, the way society should be heading, progress, etc., it's very much to do with the head. You know, it's a thinking kind of rational thing, and the spiritual side of things is the heart. You know, where are your emotions heading? And that seems to me to be, you know, this Illuminati thing from the late 1700s. Of course, the best text on that is John Robison and his book Proof of a Conspiracy Against All Religions and Governments. And you know that he was a Freemason himself, and he could see what the Illuminati were doing to Freemasonry. I think key is the press, absolutely key. The mainstream media, which is why, as someone who's worked for 3 years at the cutting edge, actually, at the BBC, I mean, I worked in one of the main newsrooms in London, which had a massive audience, and we were working with some great personalities, on-air personalities, people like Johnny Walker, who people might know. I mean, he's still on Radio 2 today, but he's a loads of personality, a real kind of, you know, intelligent but quite anti-establishment figure from the days of pirate radio. I think he was on Radio Caroline, you know. So it was great working with these people. But what I've seen is how the whole thing has been emaciated since the late 1980s, with the removal by Victor Rothschild and Margaret Thatcher of the Director General Alistair Mill in 1987. I mean, he was doing stuff which is independent of government. I'll tell you a little tale, because I was over in Russia a few years ago in Moscow talking to Russia Today, because I was doing a lot of work with them at the time, and spoke to one of their top people, the deputy news editor, actually. And I said, look, if you guys would like to do a little bit more, which was just a little bit, which is critical of Putin, everyone would watch Russia Today. But the fact that you won't do that means that you're just another propaganda service like the BBC. Anyway, the guy just looked at me. It's almost like you could wave your hand in front of his face and he wouldn't, like, you know, follow your fingers. Well, you know, there was nobody in, you know, because this is not the way that media works nowadays. But in the 1980s, up till the 1980s, the BBC had the guts and the courage to challenge the Thatcher government, and they were doing things like looking at the far right within the Conservative Party while the Tory Party was the ruling party. Since then, everybody in the BBC, pretty much, certainly all at the top higher levels, managerial levels, who even thinks about criticising the government in power, which has been, for as long as anyone can remember, the Blairites or the Tories, which is basically the same neocon faction, is removed. You know, so that's where we are with media and press. But that, I think, is, you know, that is effectively what they're up to, is they just simply, and I knew a very good producer when I was working at the BBC, actually, when I was working on something to do with the Gulf War, I think it was, first Gulf War in 91. And there was when that war broke out, there was a whole load of ships sailed out of Portsmouth. I was working down in Southampton, and we had a phone in every morning, which was very popular on Radio Solent, which is quite a big station down in the south of England. And then nobody phoned in. I thought, my God, we've got this massive news story. Loads of people are involved. And the producer turned to me and she said, "Well, we haven't told them what to think yet." And there is a bit of that about, I mean, for example, the coverage we're seeing of what's going on over in Jerusalem. There's a Zionist fundamentalism is taking over the site of the Temple Mount. And we're seeing virtually no explanation anywhere of what a Zionist fundamentalist is. We hear enough about Islamic fundamentalism, hear nothing about the countervailing force. So we're getting very, very biased press, one-sided press. And in a way, I think I would even say we're as extreme as in a pre-war situation, because that's what you get in the run-up to a war, is you get only one side. And that's what we had in the run-up to World War II. Churchill was completely kept off the airwaves. There was a whole edict saying, keep this man well away, and the appeasers were given access to the airwaves 100%. So we're seeing a similar thing today, I think, with the build-up of tensions between the, I would say, the big power blocks being China and the US, and the EU, of course, being kind of good cop to the American bad cop, and with the Russians kind of sandwiched in the middle. You know, it looks like the Russians are very much more siding with the Chinese in the global scheme of things, but the press in Britain seems to be incredibly biased against Russia and for the Americans, which is incredible since the 9/11 attacks. America has been even more of a aggressive basket case country militarily than they had been up until then, and there was enough horrendous interventions by the US military in the Pentagon up until 9/11, but it's got even worse since.
With us on Salaam Media, this is The Alternative Voice with myself, Inayat Wadi. My guest tonight, looking into the Bilderberg Group, is Tony Gosling, joining us out of the United Kingdom. Tony, just to continue and just to understand events that have been taking place right across the world, and earlier on you mentioned 9/11, and since 9/11 we've seen just so much taking place in the world. And my question to you would be, you know, how much of this has been engineered through forums like the Bilderberg Group in terms of what has taken place? We've seen the occupations of Afghanistan, Iraq. We've seen the war. We've seen the Arab Spring. You know, we've just seen so much taking place together with the turmoil in the financial markets, the meltdown in 2008 and the like. How much of it is actually engineered through forums like this?
Well, I don't think the Bilderberg is actually doing this. Sorry to disappoint you. People connected with the steering committee may well be, but the Bilderberg is much more about actually, once the policy's been decided, getting it out to the world. And also kind of crash testing it in a way. So, you know, running stuff past Peter Thiel and Eric Schmidt, people like that. You know, do you think this will run, this new policy, whatever it happens to be, or a war, you know, a potential war happening? I mean, both the Kosovo Yugoslavia conflicts, it's quite a lot of documented evidence that this was being discussed at Bilderberg before it actually happened. The same with the Iraq War, the Bilderberg conference in 2002 and 2003 had Iraq on the agenda when they manufactured this completely fake news case about mass destruction. That was all being discussed at Bilderberg. Then leaks were coming out of the conference saying they're going to attack Iraq. And I think at the time, I was one of those just raising my eyebrows and say, don't be ridiculous, you know. And then, of course, it happened. There's connections to 9/11. I think if you're looking at the way things work, how do they really work? The real bigger decisions are made elsewhere. I mean, you know, like I say, it's more of a sounding board, Bilderberg, and a way of making sure that things get out to the public. It's like a kind of, you know, this is the latest press release for you to go and read to everybody. The actual decisions, I think, are made. You know, it's difficult to know this for certain, but look at, for example, the P2 scandal in Italy back in the 1980s and 90s. Now, this really did expose a secret government in Italy, Masonic Lodge P2. And actually, that you can trace back to the Illuminati. You look at the Illuminati original writings about the Illuminati. They called their lodges propaganda lodges. So P2, Propaganda Due, was, you know, you could... you know, potentially make a link there. It does seem like it might be something connected with the Illuminati. But there was exposed a totally parallel way of running a country. You know, so you had all the theatre of what was going on in the with the Italian government and legislature, and behind the scenes, the military, the secret police, the civil police, some of them. Bankers, big bosses of the press, were all meeting up in secret at P2 and deciding what was going to happen in the country, including things like the assassination of Aldo Moro, the former prime minister. So, you know, this was being run. This is how you run a country. Of course, we had the strategy of tension there and the well-exposed now Operation Gladio, although, of course, the mainstream media still never talks about that because it shows you that these secret governments are prepared to use terrorist tactics against their own people using fascist cells to kill people right across Europe, mainly in Italy, because Italy was so left-wing and communist, they really had to stop it going to the left. They were worried that the Italians were virtually going to join the Soviet Union. You know, the Americans spent more money, the CIA, than anywhere else in the world in making sure that didn't happen. And they had what they call the years of lead, 10 years or so of just these bombs going off, people being killed apparently just by terrorists, whereas it turned out it was all being done by their own P2 secret government in order to keep the left out of power. So that and you know that amount of and when you've got the and this is one of the other characteristics of Bilderberg, when you've got the press barons sitting around the table, the top editor of, you know, people, places like The Economist, The Financial Times, these people sitting around the table, but they don't write about what's going on in their newspaper. You know, they're not working for us, they're working for themselves. And that aspect to it really disgusts me, both with the politicians and with the press that go there. As they step into that room and into that conference and swear the little oath of secrecy, you know, this Chatham House rules thing, where we can talk about what happened, but we can't attribute it to anybody, and we can't attribute it to Bilderberg. It's just a way of trying to hide this as a method to get things out to the public. At least that's the way it seems to me. And I think also I'm very active here in Britain in the Britain's 9/11 truth movement. Quite quickly after 9/11, realised that this was a false flag attack of some sort. Now it seems pretty much Israeli run. I would say the evidence is that you've got these Israeli-US dual citizens who were very much at the heart of covering up 9/11, not alone being involved in it. And that, I think, is an important thing for everyone to understand, is that this was a massive ramping up of the ability of the US to just go into any country it wanted to effectively and destroy things. But when getting back to the Bilderbergs, before I forget, you've got Mike Peters, who is a sociology professor at, I think he's retired in the last couple of years, up at Birmingham. Leeds Metropolitan University, did a fantastic paper which has got all the basic stuff, and it's written in a really witty style. It's not a boring old academic paper, called Bilderberg and the Project for European Unification. And it is really just explains the role of Bilderberg in bringing the EU into being. Now, remember, 1973, Britain joined the common market. Margaret Thatcher at the end of the 1980s, said, I am not signing over this sovereign nation to 13 unelected bankers. And that's how she saw the European Commission. But she was right, you know, of course she shouldn't have done that. And she was booted out, and John Major was put in, and then they signed the Maastricht Treaty. So that happened without people being asked. So this whole business of Brexit is very much tied in with a kind of resistance, in a weird way, against Bilderberg from within the Tory party. And I think probably a little bit of egging on by the British military, saying, no, we don't want to be part of a European army. And maybe even a little bit of elbowing by some people in the City of London, saying, look, if we give up our sovereignty, we're going to give up our currency, we may as well just become a province of Brussels.
Mm. Yes, and I think also, Tony, when one looks at the some of the objectives, and this ties in with this whole concept of a one world government, because when we look at the world today, we see how, you know, major decisions from an economic perspective are actually being dictated and using instruments like the IMF, the World Bank, and then we know of the World Economic Forum and the like as well. I think a lot of these decisions are financially motivated, Tony.
Well, the media is, I think, even more important. It's what we're allowed to think about and what we're not allowed to think about. That's what's being decided by these guys. And, you know, I'm also very active, well, say as active as I can be, in the journalists' union here in Britain. And you can see slowly but surely a stripping away of journalists' ability to write about what they want to write about. You've got a smaller and smaller number of individual proprietors who, it seems, they just want to stuff their newsrooms full of people that would say what they would say in a good given situation. I mean, George Orwell, I think it was 1942 or 43, he wrote his resignation letter from the BBC, the World Service, saying, I'm resigning because actually what you're doing here with this propaganda, he was broadcasting propaganda to India, doesn't work. And I'm actually saving you. I'm doing you a favor by resigning because I know it's not working. This propaganda is. I think we're reaching that stage now, particularly with young people, is that they might occasionally watch the news with their parents, but they get almost all of their information from social media because they don't trust the mainstream press. And so we're moving to a point where the propaganda isn't quite working the way it used to. We had the, you know, a couple of attempts now to sort of get a war going with Syria using false news stories about Assad being behind chemical weapons attacks. I mean, the fact of the matter is Seymour Hersh and Carlo Del Ponte at the UN have proven beyond any shadow of a doubt that the attempt 3 years or so ago in Ghouta to do a chemical weapons attack definitely wasn't Assad. It definitely was the rebels, so-called rebels, who, you know, it looks now as if the chemical weapons are smuggled through with the help of Hillary Clinton through from Libya, from Benghazi to Syria to do that attack. So, you know, the media is really culpable. I can't stress enough. They are now the Schwerpunkt, as Hitler's generals would call them, you know, the spearhead of the war machine. And there is no real balance left in the British press on anything that matters. They will talk, I would say, something like 85-90% of the news stories we get are inane, innocuous, and you know, there may be a bit of balance in those. But in the things that really matter to the elite, the war machine, they're lies, always lies, and they're always 100%. I mean, all this stuff we've seen, for example, about the so-called Trump-Russia scandal, you know, the leaking the hacking by the Russians of emails. It's not a hack, it's a leak. We know pretty much now, through the death of Seth Rich at the Democratic National Convention, he was just disgusted by the way Hillary Clinton was cheating in the presidential election and stealing the Democratic nomination from Bernie Sanders. He decided to hand over these emails. It looks like possibly to Craig Murray, the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, who flew over to the US at that time and then took some of this, it looks like, back to Julian Assange in London. Now, you know, those people probably would deny that happened, but then that's their job to deny it because they're good journalists covering their sources. But I reckon that that's what happened. And so, we're getting this again and again, even on the news today, again and again. Oh, the nasty Russians are hacking this, that and everything else. It's a completely dysfunctional mainstream press. And we desperately need I think, a new broom in British politics, which can start appointing real journalists. I mean, I've seen just today in The Guardian an article about the MMR vaccine, for example, where you can see that the journalists in The Guardian are just writing from a press release from the big pharmaceutical industry saying that this is a wonderful vaccine. It's going to cure so many people, with no inkling of an idea that possibly this is just like a disguised advert for the pharmaceutical industry.
Yes, and also, Tony, I think I read somewhere, and I'm sure it was on your website, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, where, you know, when one looks at the modus operandi in terms of how these people work and how they operate, and there was mention of going after the Muslims first and then after unembedded journalists and the like. So clearly is a whole plan in making it.
I think, yeah, it's really important, I think, that everybody compares what's happening to Islam today to what happened to Judaism under Hitler in the 1930s. You know, that seems to me pretty obvious that's what's going on. We're seeing, you know, I'm in touch with a lot of individual Muslims here in Bristol, some of the most law-abiding, kindest, gentlest people you'll ever meet, very spiritual, you know, and yet we're being told there's this kind of terrible, and we're never told about the Zionist project, the origins of it, really. The you know, I look at Britain and I do sometimes hang my head in shame. You know, you look at what happened with the, you know, the discovery of America, which happened from Bristol here, supposedly discovery, because of course there were Native Americans already there, but with John Cabot in 1497 1498, his trips from Bristol to reconnaissance for genocide, I would call it. And in the creation of this monstrosity, the United States of America, which has got, you know, millions of wonderful people, but the actual running of it by the Pentagon, by the arms industries, by money, by the banksters, is, you know, an absolute blight on humanity. And then what did the British do? Is that they also were involved in the creation of the State of Israel, you know. So the Brits are responsible for all sorts of dreadful things. But look, we mentioned briefly, didn't we, about the origins of Bilderberg. I'd like to go back to that,
yes,
if that's all right. Because I've discovered some pretty amazing stuff about that, which is to do with the Battle of Arnhem. That is to say, the film A Bridge Too Far in the Second World War was exactly 10 years before the first Bilderberg conference was put together. And that battle, I mean, I had a pretty good look at it. Obviously, you had a look at the film first, but it's pretty clear the British let the side down. I mean, talking about the tanks on the ground, for those that don't know, it was the British Montgomery's attempt to, in September 1944, to get a bridgehead over the Rhine. And that was actually quite a potentially nifty manoeuvre, getting round the German defences, the Siegfried Line, and going into the Ruhr to really cut off the supplies to the German armies through the Patton was fighting in the south in Europe, and really destroy the Nazi Empire very quickly through getting it into their manufacturing base in those areas. Anyway, if you look into this battle, you'll find that there was an opportunity with the paratroopers that had been parachuted into Arnhem. They were hanging on by their fingernails, and the Americans had managed to get the Nijmegen Bridge. So there was something like 15 miles or so for these British troops to go, and we now know there was nothing to stop them. They could have taken the bridge at Arnhem and relieved the British who were airborne troops, the 1st Airborne Division, who were there. John Frost has written about this in his books, saying that nobody ever told him that there were any Panzer units, SS units near Arnhem, that it was going to be a breeze, a walk-in, you know. So there was collusion from behind the scenes in order, I think, to throw that fight. I actually spoke to a guy called Major Tony Hibbert before he died. He was the brigade major at the bridge at Arnhem. And he said, oh, we were all convinced that it was going to end the war by Christmas. We were absolutely up for it because we knew it was a very savvy maneuver. And the troops on the ground were just not given orders to actually get to the Arnhem Bridge. They had every opportunity to do it. They could have got there within 20 minutes or so, and yet they were held back. Now, I spoke to Moffat Burris as well, who's an American paratrooper,
who was in the 82nd Airborne Division, and he actually talks about going to Lord Carrington, who was in a tank at Nijmegen Bridge, the one just before Arnhem, and pointing a gun to his head, look, just go down the road and look after your mates, or I'll blow your blankety-blank head off. And he wouldn't. He said, I've got no orders to do it. I'm staying here. So there was this ridiculous sort of few hours where the battle could have been won. But the British corps of tanks, we're talking about hundreds of tanks, just sat in Nijmegen and waited and waited until the Nazis finished off the British at the Arnhem Bridge and then surrounded the 1st Airborne Division in a pocket, which was called the Witch's Cauldron, the Hexen Kessel. And it was exactly the same spot as this Hexen Kessel was, which was the Witch's Cauldron in the Battle of Arnhem, which is where the first Bilderberg meeting took place, which I know, I think this is a bit of an in-joke amongst the Nazis. I know, you know, 10 years later, let's start a little meeting between the traitors on the Allied side who were doing deals with the Nazis to give them safe passage after the war in exchange for gold.
Yes.
And other looted billions. And that was an in-joke. It was the Bilderberg Hotel in Oosterbeek in Holland, and it's in exactly the same spot as the British were massacred in Arnhem, because a certain general, Brian Horrocks, and a airborne general who was called Boy Browning, just simply didn't seem to want to fight that day. In fact, there's in the scene, Robert Redford in the film is playing the American colonel, I think, who comes up to the Brits and said, why don't you get down the road? And he gets really angry with him. He says, well, you're sitting around drinking tea, you know, after I've just lost half my men, you know, getting you this bridge. And now you're going to sit around and drink a cup of tea. So there, I think we have it. We have the traitors in this part of the world. That is the Brits. I'm including in that people like Desmond Morton, very important figure, who was Churchill's personal secretary. People who had decided they were going to take the Nazi money and they were going to look after the Nazis at the end of the war. And, of course, Churchill, many people don't realise this, but Churchill, after World War II, had to be kept off the television here in Britain, the new TV stations, because he was talking about he wanted to nuke Moscow. And that was the plan of a lot of people in Britain. And some of the senior officers were talking about joining together with a German army that hadn't had the guns taken off of it and just going straight after the Russians. And some people wanted to do that. Churchill particularly was a real big enthusiast for let's just take out Russia, you know. So those were the motives, I think. And of course, we also know about things like Paperclip, Operation Paperclip, where lots of Nazis were incorporated into the, you know, US military system. And not only that, people like Reinhard Gehlen, who was the one of the top Nazis on the intelligence people on the Eastern Front in World War II, was just put in charge of the new West German intelligence. So no wonder the Russians were a bit annoyed after World War II that it seemed that Brits and the Americans wanted to take advantage of the peace to just pursue another war immediately. And in a way, they're following on from what happened right the way back to Napoleon, where there's been this kind of obsession about controlling Russia. But thankfully, the Russians are too smart for that.
Yes, in fact, Tony, it's been a fascinating discussion and a great insight into the Bilderberg Group with you. And I know you've got to leave a bit early, so I'm not going to keep you much longer. But for now, thank you very much for that and for your time with us.
I would just also say, if you don't mind, is the Bilderberg.org website. It's got lots of stuff about the origins of the Bilderberg conferences over the years, including we did a program called A Bridge Not Far. So that's, if you want to hear about the evidence that connects the traitors in World War II on the Allied side to the Bilderberg conferences after. I mentioned Peter Carrington there. He was in the Guards Armoured Division during the war, one of these tanks that didn't go and meet up with the Brits that were hanging on in Arnhem. And he then became a chairman of the Bilderberg conferences afterwards. But then there's also Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was very much involved in that campaign as a Dutch liaison officer. And it's almost certain now that he was the person that gave all the plans for Operation Market Garden to the Nazis beforehand through a spy. His spy, a guy called Christian Lindemans, King Kong, was sent in a few days beforehand and went straight to the Abwehr because he was a Nazi agent, even though Bernhard had trusted him. So there were some interesting figures at the end of World War II who were much more interested in making money and doing deals with Nazis, embracing Nazis, giving them safe passage after the war than they were in actually winning the war. And of course, thousands, if not tens of thousands of people suffered, and the war was extended from Christmas 1944 right the way through for another few months. Another thing you could look at if you're interested is the survival of Martin Bormann. I don't know if you've been into that before, but Hitler's Reich Chancellor, who was in charge of the Nazi Party, very definitely survived World War II, and I've been digging out quite a lot about evidence of that through books like OpJB, with John Ainsworth Davis wrote that. Christopher Crichton was his pen name, and that's a whole other side to things, because the Brits basically brought him out at the end of the war and used that Nazi loot for all sorts of nefarious purposes after the war.
Well, Tony, you've whet my appetite, and I'm sure I'm going to be doing a lot more reading, but also certainly we're going to be talking with you, because I think there's just so many issues when we drill down, and I'm sure we will get into certain specifics at another occasion. But for now, thank you very much for your time. We certainly do appreciate it. All the best to you.
Thank you very much for inviting me on. I'll also plug another website I do, which is the 9/11 Forum. It's www.911forum.org.uk, where we're just looking at all sorts of terrorist attacks around the world, sort of really commenting on them as they happen and pulling apart things like the various attacks before the general election here in Britain, as well as 9/11 itself, which is still, unraveling.
Yes, well, certainly we will get onto those websites. But Tony, thank you very much again. All the best to you.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.